Okay, thanks everybody, and welcome to another edition of what we're still calling Conversations with Dr. Cowan and Friends. And today, an old friend now, Mike Stone, from the unpronounceable word virolog, I think. Something like that. I think you made it so that nobody could pronounce it properly. But I think everybody gets the point that virology has issues, as they say. And Mike writes brilliant pieces, I must say. They're extremely well-conceived, well-researched, and well-presented. And Mike wrote one on gain of fiction, I think it's called. I'm not sure that's the exact title. But and I'm doing a webinar basically on that this afternoon. And so I thought it would be good to compliment, to let Mike go through more exactly what they're doing in these gain of fiction experiments. And then we'll dissect a little bit the Boston one. And so I think that will help people really understand exactly why this is fiction. Before we did that, and I ran this by Mike, I think he's okay with this. Another way to think of this is, in a way to orient yourself, is the concept of surrogate testing. Now, what do I mean by surrogate testing? A surrogate test means, just to give you a very simple example, if you want to have a pregnancy test. Now, I think this is a very clear example, because in that case, you have what is sometimes called a gold standard test, which means you take, say, a four-month pregnant woman, and you do an ultrasound and palpate and listen to the heartbeat. And if all those things are positive, in other words, you hear a heartbeat, mother's, you know, belly swelling, and you can see the baby on the ultrasound, that's a positive confirmation that you have a pregnancy. Now, I would also say that even then you have to be careful, because you could, just because a woman's belly swells doesn't mean she's pregnant. And you even have to, and this may sound funny, but if you do an ultrasound, there is even the question, does doing an ultrasound, meaning exposing somebody's abdomen to high intensity sound waves, does that create the appearance of a fetus? Now, I would say the answer is highly, highly unlikely that no, it doesn't. But if possible, one would want to do a control experiment and make sure that's not the case. It may not be possible, but that is something that actually should be done. And even the heartbeat, you know, you could be hearing something, you could be hearing the aortic aneurysm or something. So I ran this by somebody and he said, you know, the only real gold standard is when the baby comes out. Then you know. Now, if you have that, and then you want to do a surrogate test, which is not a test for whether there's a baby in there directly, it's a test for the level of a hormone in the blood or a protein or a chemical. Now, you can do that on 100 women and say, you know, they all deliver babies. And if 100% of them at 2 months are positive, then you can say this test, you know, can be used as a surrogate for finding pregnancy without having to wait for the baby. And you know that you validated the test against something you know to be true. And then you can also find false negatives and false positives. So you can do it on 100 men, and if 3 are positive, you have a 3% false positive rate. Because it may be that somebody has a tumor that secretes, you know, HCG. And so if you have 3 women who deliver babies and their test was negative below a certain threshold, then you know you have a 3% false negative rate. And when you do all those steps, validate there's a pregnancy, Do it on people who you know can't possibly be pregnant. Do it on people you know absolutely are pregnant. Then you end up with a valid test. Now, the problem in virology is not only have they never validated any of the tests against anything they know to be true, you don't even actually know there's a pregnancy. You don't even know if anybody has proved that there's a baby in there, in which case you end up using surrogate tests like PCR tests and antigen tests and antibody tests and genomes and even, I would say, cell cultures. Those are all surrogate tests because they can't do the thing that we would all use to prove it, which is isolate, find, purify the particle from a sick person. And in a sense, that's the origin of all this trouble, because it turns out every time you actually do, you know, proper controls to validate a surrogate test for a virus, turns out not to be specific for a virus. You can get these sequences from breakdown of lung tissue or bacterial tissue or fungal tissue. And you can get antibodies against non-specific things and on and on and on, in which case you end up with an unproven assumption, which is that there is a baby in there. You've never seen the baby. You can't prove it. And that's the whole sort of fallacy behind virology and the gain of function. Because I think, as we'll see from Mike, it's one surrogate test after another, or one surrogate experiment or example after another, none of which are correlated to anything which is the particle or the issue. And so it becomes appropriately named gain of fiction, not gain of function. And I don't know if you agree with what I just said, Mike. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think if that seems right to you, maybe you could explain what they're actually doing with this gain of fiction so we can actually see what's happening. And yeah. Again, thanks for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. So gain of function, basically it came to prominence like around 2012, or at least that term, the terminology, due to some studies. I believe there are two studies with the avian influenza virus where they were trying to make it transmissible between ferrets through the air. And so it caused a little bit of a stir where they were concerned that if these studies got out there, if they were published, that someone would get a hold of it. They would see this blueprint for how they could make a influenza that wasn't as virulent into something more so, and then they could release it upon the world and become more pathogenic. So essentially what these...
Mike, let me stop you for a minute. Maybe just give a definition of what is supposedly meant by gain of function.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to get to. Gain of function, what they're essentially trying to do with these experiments is to create a virus that is more pathogenic, or in some cases, they'll try to make it more transmissible, or they can try to get it to jump from one species to another. So they have gain of function and loss of function. Gain of function means that you're gaining some form of virulence from it, making it more pathogenic. Loss of function means it's less pathogenic, less transmissible. So that's essentially what they are doing or claiming to do during these studies. When you get down into them, basically what it is the same old cell culture tricks that we see every time with all these foundational virology papers. They're just taking a sample from someone. They don't purify and isolate any viruses from that, whether it's a lung, the fluids from the lungs or the blood. And then they put it through a culture. normally a cancer cell line or a fetus or the green African green monkey, the Vero cells. And then they basically combine culture supernatants from different viruses, or they're claimed to be within these supernatants. And from these cultures, they further culture them, and then we'll do experiments on the animals. And if they make those animals sick in any way, you know, they'll measure it subjectively. Then they claim that that is how they've created a more virulent strain of a virus.
So, you know, one has the impression that, you know, from reading the people who espouse this gain of function stuff, that they have a purified virus, meaning a particle that has a protein coat and a piece of genetic interior. And so that this particle has a certain genome, right? Whatever it is, a coronavirus or influenza virus. And then they say that somebody inserts, and I've always been interested, like with a tweezers.
Exactly, like, the little clippers and going in there.
Yeah, they insert a piece of an HIV or a smallpox virus or some other virus that's really bad. So they take a piece of that genome and somehow glue it into the genome of the normal flu virus or normal coronavirus. And now you end up with a new stable genome of this gained of function new version of the flu virus or the coronavirus. And what I think you're saying is that guy with the tweezers doesn't exist. They don't have a guy with the tweezers doing that.
Well, no, I mean, they don't even start off, you know, they just assume that the viruses are in these fluids to begin with. I mean, I would love to see it if they were going to do these studies, you know, show the purified isolated virus. Like, let's say they're in the case of the Boston study, which we'll talk about, you know, if they have the Omicron strain, let's see the purified isolated Omicron strain. Let's see a nice electron microscope image of those particles. Let's see.
With a certain genome proven from that Omicron.
Yeah, absolutely. And then show us the one that they're going to mix it with. So now you're talking about the original strain, the Wuhan strain. They're calling it the original. But so then show us that one that they've actually purified, isolated it, that they've gotten the genome and all that. And then when they combine those two, let's see the finished product. Let's see what this new virus is. They've, you know, obviously, if they're creating it, they should be able to purify and isolate and get this new virus that they claim to have. You never see any of that. You know, they don't attempt purification, let alone isolation, and they never show actual images of what they claim to be producing through these experiments.
And you would also expect them to show you the new. The new hybrid genome.
Right.
And then the next step would be to prove that is a stable genome. And so all the subsequent progeny of that particle have the identical genome as the chimeric one that they made.
Right.
But that never happens.
No, and they even did that with the avian flu one it was done by Ron Fauci, I think, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the guy who, you know, in 2003 apparently satisfied Koch's postulates, but really didn't, just did Rivers. Right. So in his study, when they went through this and they claimed that the new virus that they created had transferred from the ferrets that were inoculated onto the cage ferrets next to them. So somehow it, you know, spread airborne. They couldn't get the same genome. You know, they said from the parent ferret, the one that was infected, the genome differed to the one that was, you know, transmitted airborne. So they can never get the same full genome or sequences. They just, then we'll say, well, they might find a few mutations here and there that line up between the two, but then there's a whole bunch of other ones that don't match up, and they're like, oh, don't worry about those. We at least found, you know, a few that kind of match up. So they can do whatever they want. They can manipulate this data however they feel like to try and create the picture that they've, you know, successfully transmitted it, but it's just data.
Do you have a, can you explain, because people sometimes ask me this, how they even come up with the conclusion that this first thing they're talking about, this first variant of the virus, is Omicron, not the Wuhan strain?
Oh, how they determined that, like when they were doing, it's just through, you know, PCR testing. They check it, see if the genome matches, and then they say, well, that's our Omicron strain is in this sample, and we've got our original Wuhan based on the PCR testing results that they get from that one, whatever genome. So
in other words, they put different primers in.
Right.
And the primers that they say are from the Omicron strain, which have never been validated. That's a surrogate test that's never been validated against a particle that we know has a certain genome.
Right.
So they say this PCR primers are match this sample, not that sample. So this is Omicron and that's another one.
Exactly.
Do you have a theory or an explanation as to why some PCR primers match certain samples and not others?
I think it's just based on the recipe that they're creating through these cell cultures. I mean, unless they are doing them all the same way, which we know they don't, you know, depending on which cell line they use, however much, you know, the DMEM, the minimal essential media that they use, or, you know, if they're using 2% fetal bovine serum or 10%, you know, that right there will give you quite a bit of genetic material just from the fetal cow blood alone. Yeah. You know, the different, I mean, they all have different recipes. So, you know, if this is the Omicron strain, this is the recipe you'll follow, even though they don't all follow it. They get, you know, generally close to that. This is the cell line you use. This is the chemicals that you use. And if you want a different strain, here's the, you know, the recipe for that. And so then you go with your primers and the PCR and you look for whatever it is and you try to get it as close as possible through that process.
So it's also partly using a different template. So you're telling the computer to match it to an elephant instead of a rhinoceros. And lo and behold, it does, because that's what it's trying to create.
Yeah, well, they have the reference genome for Omicron. They'll try to match whatever puzzle pieces they have to that from that soup. And then they'll have, you know, the original strain. They'll have a different template and try to match it to that. I mean, you know, a good control would be to see if they could take and get the Omicron from the Wuhan strain or not, you know, depending on whether they map it to that reference.
Yeah, right. So you could take the original strain, map it to a Omicron reference, and you'd get that one even in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Or and even if even if that's never been done, the interesting question is, why don't they do that as a control and see whether that's true or not?
Exactly.
Like that would be an obvious step, but they don't do. So again, walk us through. So now what, when we see these patents and all that, you know, so what did they do to get this hybrid strain, they say?
Oh, for which one?
For the SARS-CoV-2, for instance.
Oh.
I mean, that's the claim is, you know, Ralph Baric or somebody made SARS-CoV-2. So how, what did they actually do?
I, you know, that's a good question. I apologize. I don't have a really good answer for what they did to get those patents. I imagine, you know, they come up with whatever technique that they want to use, whether it's reverse genetics or I know they used in the Boston study a different type of PCRs, like circular PCR and things along those lines. You see they always, you know, come up with some sort of new technology or a way of doing something. They have their own, what's the word I'm looking for? Like algorithm or not really algorithm, but like a, it's the best word for it is a recipe. You know, this
it's like a flow
protocol,
chart,
like a protocol. Yeah, exactly. A flow chart that they use. And then they say, here it is. Here's a workflow for how you can get this. But does anyone ever validate that or, you know, attempt it outside independently to make sure that that workflow actually is reproducible or replicable? They don't. So I'm sure, you know, you can get patents for basically almost anything, whether it works or not.
But, right.
Yeah.
Right. So they have sequences, but they don't know whether that the sequence, you know, they say we took a protein from HIV or a sequence from HIV and mixed it with a beta coronavirus, but they don't prove the existence of the beta coronavirus or the HIV. And so they probably do mixtures of cell cultures and then PCR and get sequences and say that that's how it was so-called transfected, which means mixed together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you have, you know, a soup with a certain sequence and then you combine it with another one that you determine the sequence with and you put them together, you know, most likely you'll be able to at least find something similar, some of the similar sequences once you've combined and cultured them. And I pretty much that's what it looks like to me what they're doing through these research, at least on the genomic side.
Yeah. Okay, how about if we go through in detail that Boston study? I don't know if you can share your screen and
I'm the least tech savvy person in the world, so I do not know how to share
it to me. But I know how to get you to, I think now you can share your screen.
Okay.
If you can pull that, actually we can go through that study or just the paper that you wrote. I think that was enough of describing the methods.
Sure. I'd have to get to it. Sorry, 1 second. Can you see my screen right now?
No.
Oh, it's not pulling up?
No, but I think you should be able to do it if you hit the share screen green thing at the bottom.
Oh, is that what that is? Oh, okay. And then share.
Yep.
Okay. Great. So let's try this again.
Got it.
Okay. So we're going down to the Boston study, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, I just passed it. Okay.
Go up to that one before the methods of.
The methods here?
Yeah. There was some. Yeah, go down a little bit. Yeah, that one.
Okay, yeah, so here's the methods from what they did.
So, is this the Boston study or
this is a different? Yeah, this is the Boston University study where they're claiming that they create a more lethal 80% fatality rate Omicron strain in Boston. And the one that Del Bigtree, you know, was claiming that, you know, now Boston, downtown Boston could see a release of a pathogen and start this whole process over again. That's the one.
Okay. Yeah, let's go through this. So if you could describe what they did here.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you can see, just from the start, they're using the same a mixture. Like when they claim that they create a chimeric recombinant SARS-CoV-2 Omicron strain. And so chimeric meaning that they're combining multiple cells. Recombinant is genetically modified DNA. So you can see that they have multiple cell lines. They've got, you know, the human embryonic kidney cells, the human lung adenocarcinoma cells, so human lung cancer cells, human colorectal adenocarcinoma cells, and the African green monkey kidney cells. So they utilized all these different cell lines and cultured their virus using the DMEM maintenance media or minimal essential media. They combined it with 10% fetal bovine serum, non-essential amino acids, and then they used a lentiviral delivery system to generate cells that were, they said, expressed the human ACE2
And what is a lentiviral delivery system?
So what they're claiming there, from my understanding, is that they're taking a lentiviral, kind of like what they do with the adenovirus, and they're using that virus as a way to plug in certain genes or proteins, whatever it is that they are, amino acids, things along those lines, and they're claiming that that delivers it to the wherever they want it to go.
Do you know what they're actually doing?
As far as how they perform that, no. Yeah. I apologize. I'm not like.
Yeah.
With genomics, it's an area that I've scratched the surface on. I mean, there's so much to it to try and delve into each one of these.
Areas, right.
It takes a lot of work, and so I want to delve into that more, but I apologize. I don't have a good answer.
No, that's fine. It's a quagmire, but basically, yes. they're claiming they're using one viral genome, as I think they call it, a plasmid, to insert itself into another virus, but it's actually not that at all. There's nobody with a tweezers. There's no virus with a cut and paste apparatus. It's just it's these cell cultures.
Yeah, it's just combining the different, different supernatants with some different added synthetic chemicals, and they'll use PCR to try and get whatever sequence they want, and then claim that, voila, magic, they've got their new recombinant chimeric virus. But
so let's go through that first sentence. What is anti-SARS-CoV nucleocapsid protein antibody?
Yeah, so that's what they're claiming is the specific, the antibody that's specific for the N protein of SARS-CoV-2. But, we all know antibodies are definitely not specific. They've shown that over and over again. So they're just talking about here that they've created, I believe they bought this one, antibody that's supposedly specific to this protein, so that they can stain it and then say, oh, look, there's the protein. We've got it in our solution.
Right. And again, that's far from proof that protein actually exists. These antibodies, are not, quote, monoclonal at all. They're not specific for that protein. They bind to all kinds of things. So you have there's no controls to know whether this actually is the protein or not.
Exactly. And then you can see that it was something that, was gifted to them, or at least the expression plasmid for the spike protein was gifted to them. And then they claim that they replaced the Wuhan. So this is kind of what you're talking about, where they go in with the tweezers and they replace the spike protein from the Wuhan strain with the chemically. So it's not even like one that they, took from apparently the actual Omicron. They chemically synthesized a version of the Omicron spike protein through this whole process. So they, they're going from an artificial creation that they got in the lab and then saying that they put it into the old strain with their tweezers, their magical genomic tweezers.
And probably do they tell us actually how they did that?
Step by step, that's a good question. I don't believe, that's the thing, it's trying to piece through every single step that they do. I don't know how a researcher, like anyone who is trying to replicate this independently, how they would be able to go through and do these steps on their own, because it's just kind of a mess. But
there's no, I did this and I did that and I did that. They don't actually
no step by that. Step. Right.
So that's not you can't replicate this. So therefore it's actually not science.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it fails as science right off the bat because they're not working with any sort of valid independent variable. So we're just basically into fantasy land through, even trying to break this thing apart. There's so many methods involved. And I think, you can kind of link it back to with what Harold Hillman talked about with, EM images. like when you take the tissue and you remove it from an animal, and then you take it through those various steps just to prepare for an electron microscope image. Once you've done that, it's so far removed from what it really would have been that it's no longer really even valuable. That's kind of how I view these, you know, gain of function studies or just cell culture in general. You've removed it and added so much to it that it doesn't even resemble the thing that you started off with. So,
right.
Anyway.
Okay. So what is this that top sentence, the SARS-CoV-2, you know, Omicron virus was generated, blah, blah, blah. What does that mean?
So this is just, they're just talking about how they created their Omicron stock through cell culture methods, you know, grown with the usual DMEM, the 10% fetal bovine serum. They added the non-essential amino acids in there. And then they did, you know, they look for, so they inoculated in the collection medium. So they took the nasal swab from the SARS-CoV-2 patient and put it in with this whole, you know, confluence of different cell lines and additives. And then that's how they grow their Omicron. So again, it's just the same cell culture things we see all the time in these virology papers. So they don't start off with the virus. They grow the virus through their cell culture and then claim that that's in there and that's what they're using for these studies.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So then they get the CPE and then they harvest the culture media, meaning they got the liquid supernatant.
Yeah. And you'll see like they're constantly throughout there. So 24 hours after they infected the cell, they replaced it with more medium. So they put, you know, new DMEM in. This time it looks like they lowered the fetal bovine serum to 2%, put more amino acids in. So you see them do this all the time. And just that alone can cause the cytopathic effect, you know, just tampering with the cell culture. Changing the fluids, passaging it, that alone can cause CPE. So, you know, is it an effect that there's a virus in there, or is it because of the numerous processes that they're putting these cells through and stressing them throughout there that we're getting this result that they want to say confirms their Omicron?
Right. So then they next day, as you said, they're changed it even again to from 1% or 2%. So that they keep messing with it. Okay.
Exactly. Just over and over again. So, the next day, the culture medium. So we already talked about that. Let's see. So this was a stock. So this is where they, are looking for, different stocks with the 37. So again, just more, culturing. So now they have two times the DMEM with 4% fetal bovine serum, and then this Avicel DuPont, which, if I remember correctly, is some sort of product from, that is used or derived from wood, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So again, it's just a mixture of a bunch of random different chemicals put together in a petri dish to claim that their virus is in there. Here you are. So the recombinant SARS-CoV-2 generated by the, I believe it's called circular PCR. So this is generated by using a modified form of the recently published CPR protocol. So that's the fun thing when you go through these papers. So you have to, they're not telling us what that protocol is. You have to actually go search it out. So you have to find this recently published CPER protocol, and then you'll get the full details of what they're doing. And it's just a fun detective job that you eventually have to do. So then they are saying that they cloned it into a bacterial artificial chromosome for the SARS-CoV-2 cDNA. Then they use as a template to amplify the viral genome. So this is just where they're talking about. So they're creating the different fragments through this genetic processing and then attempting to claim that they're combining it when they put the cultures together.
Right. Okay. And then they have a whole bunch of things about different viruses, which are probably just different cell cultures.
Exactly. So they're containing a hepatitis delta virus, ribosome, the bovine growth hormone. I'm going to murder all these things. Polyadenylation signals sequence, the cytomegalovirus. It really lives up to that whole chimeric and definition when they're saying that they're claiming to put a lot of different cells together, or the recombinant edit of just a whole soup of genetic material that they're putting together, and then this is what they're using to eventually forcibly shove down the mice's nasal passages when they're put to sleep.
Right. And so then they tell you the essentially the PCR parameters, and they bring it up to 98 degrees, and then they do 35 cycles, and then they bring it down and bring it up. And so they get all this different supernatants from different cell cultures claiming they're all different viruses. But what they really are is different lines of cell cultures with different medium and different amino acids and different parameters. They say those are means, it's a question of how do you get a different virus? You put a different culture and then it breaks down into a little different way and you call that a different virus, or you put different chemicals in. So they mix those all together and then they amplify it in their PCR process, or at least that's what they say that's doing. And that's when they tell you that they know the proteins or the sequences that are in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so after they created this, this toxic mixture, they took the 12 to 20 week old mice and they put them under general anesthesia some sort of anesthesia, and then intranasally inoculated them with this soup. And after that, they, they monitored them. They had a subjective scale. I believe they say it in here somewhere.
So let's stop there for a minute. So now they have this mixture of the fluid from cell cultures, which has, it looks like, I don't know how many, I lost count, different types of cell culture supernatant all mixed together, put through the PCR, heating, cooling, adding chemicals, all that stuff. Then they do an analysis of that and say that it's got certain sequences which make it into a new hybrid organism. And now we're going to see what this nasty stuff does to mice, right?
Yeah,
that's exactly where we're at.
Yes. That's
So how are we going to see what it does to mice? So first thing, we're going to use isoflurane anesthesia and squirt it under pressure down their nose.
Exactly. Yep. So they put that down their nose, and then they created a subjective scale where you can see that they were looking for, whether they lost 10 to 19% body weight, respiration, if they had rapid or shallow breathing with increased effort, the appearance, if they had ruffled fur or hunched over posture, responsiveness, if they had low to moderate unresponsiveness, and neurologic signs, tremors. So, all the telltale signs of COVID-19 they were looking for in these mice. And then what you eventually find out, so they had this grading scale where 1 to 4, but they essentially admitted, let me see if I go back up here. I think it's up here, right in this section in the extended data figure. So animals losing 20% of their body weight, which was 8 out of 10 of them, were euthanized. So they, looked at these animals and they subjectively, determined whether they had these symptoms or not. But essentially, as long as they had 20% weight loss, they were killed. So the virus did not kill these animals. The researchers did.
Got it. And the criteria for who got killed was if you lose 20% of your weight after having stuff squirted down your nose and anesthetized, then that's called you died.
Yeah, that the virus killed you. And I think they even did that with they said, I think their control was the regular Wuhan strain, the old version. They said 6 out of 6 died. But again, I think it was because they lost 20% of the weight and they killed them. So they can claim, you know, that one has 100% fatality rate. The new version, the Omicron with the old strain with the new Omicron spike killed 80%. Well, honestly, neither of those viruses killed any of them. The researchers killed them after they determined this 20% weight loss was sufficient, that the virus had done enough damage to them. Basically.
So wait a minute, Mike. So you mean when they did a control, so-called, of exposing these mice in the same way to the original Wuhan strain?
That's what they said. Yeah. So the one that they used to build their new Omicron strain with, you know, so they took the spike from the Omicron and put it onto this old Wuhan strain. They said that they used that same Wuhan strain and infected the mice. And those mice, again, 6 out of 6 lost their body weight or whatever, and they killed them.
So why wouldn't that lead you to the conclusion that the original Wuhan strain was worse than the new one?
Well, the funny part is that's what they were arguing. So when Dell and Robert Kennedy and all these people were calling this gain of function, they were claiming, well, no, this is actually loss of function because the original strain killed 100% of the mice. And then this new one that we created only killed 80%. But
right. Well,
the other argument was, well, you took Omicron, which killed none of them, and you made it 80% more lethal. So
did they do a mice with what they call the Omicron strain?
Yes. Sorry. So they did do the Omicron strain, and the researchers left all of them alive. So
got it.
They did not euthanize any of those mice.
All right. So essentially what they did was the original one, they killed 100%. The Omicron one, they say, killed 0. And
right.
The new Omicron killed 80%, which
right.
is less than the original one. But that's bad because it's somehow a hyped up Omicron.
Right. Right. And what's interesting, the research in this paper did not admit this, but I was rereading before I was coming on here, the one that Fauci did in 2012. And they actually admit that, you know, taking, and this was talking about ferrets, but you can apply it to mice, but they said, you know, taking these weakened ferrets, so immunocompromised ferrets, which technically is what they're doing with these mice because they're claiming they're transgenically altered. But you're taking these weakened ferrets and you're knocking them out and then you're shoving this goo in their nose, that does not reflect how humans would catch the disease. So you can't really extrapolate the data from these studies on how it would affect human, which is, you know, you can't really extrapolate much from these studies, but at least they're being honest that this is not natural. There's nothing natural about this process of what they're doing, you know, creating the soup, knocking the animals out, injecting it into them, and then claiming that this virus is, you know, this is how it would, you know, affect humans. You can't do that. And then this is the beautiful cartoon that they show how they were doing it. So you take a little spike there, add it to this one over here, and then shove it down the noses
of the mice. And yeah, it's horrible.
Virus killed 80% of them, though. We know it's the researchers who killed 80% of them.
Right.
But that's how they conjure us up. And so, you know, the funny thing is they had these headlines, you know, saying that these researchers created this 80% strain, and people just go off and start running off of the headlines and creating these, you know, fun little scary tales to try and whip people into a frenzy. And if you look into the study, you can see it's just, that's absolutely not what happened. And so it's just obvious to me, anyone who promoted this as a sort of gain of function obviously didn't read the study themselves. It would have been, you know, crystal clear to them that just first of all, it's just a giant mess of pseudoscience, but that the researchers were the reason that these animals died, not the virus.
Right.
Or not the so-called virus that they claimed was in there, or that they created. Right.
And even the fact that there was no control of anesthetizing and sticking, you know, uninfected stuff down their nose or saline down their nose or anything down their nose in this sort of way invalidates any claim of being scientific from in this study.
Absolutely. They didn't factor in the environment that these animals are kept in, or just the stress of being having this stuff shoved in their noses, or the effects of the anesthesia on them. So of course that could cause lethargy, or any of the other symptoms, may even cause ruffled fur. Who knows? Did they test that by itself? No, they didn't.
Yeah. So. Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about what you found out about gain of function type stuff?
Well, I'll just say this, the gain of function, it's become more of a highlight recently, obviously with COVID, or with the coronavirus and the whole lab leak, origin story and everything. But, they've been doing this type of stuff ever since virology started. This is not new. And they've been saying what they do is passaging these viruses through various animals. Even in the case of polio, what they did was, they grounded up the spine of a diseased 9-year-old, injected it into monkeys, and from the monkeys they took their brains and injected, ground that up and injected it into ferrets, and then from the ferrets they ground up their brains and injected them. So they've been doing this type of passaging and trying to say that they're making these more virulent strains since the dawn of virology. So this is not new. They're just trying to create a new spin with it, with all the genomic data now.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Anything else on your mind here?
I think that pretty much covers it.
All right. So everybody, I think, go to, tell us your website again.
Sure. Virology.com. Spelled VIROLIEGY.com. So just to make sure people emphasize that it's all a lie. But there you can find me there, or I do have a Substack now. I believe it's just under Mike Stone Substack, but it's the Virology newsletter. I do articles there as well. So if you want to follow that.
And if anybody wants to look further into this whole gain of function, I would strongly encourage reading Mike's article and also Mark Bailey in his, I can't remember what it's called, Farewell to Virology, I think.
Yeah. Can I also point out too, that's another thing, when Sam had a really great video about this, Virology Nights. If no one's seen that, I would check it out, because they did a great breakdown of this whole gain of function nonsense. And they even they calculated, I forgot to mention this when we were talking about the amount that they're putting in these mouse. So the amount of the culture soup is like about a half a cup that they're injecting into the mice. Yeah. So, that's quite a bit of material you're shoving down these mice, and so
baby mice. Fine. That's what you call having a bad day.
Yeah,
you're a mouse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Mike. Thanks for everything you're doing. Keep in touch, and we'll be in touch.
Sounds great. Thank you, Tom.
Okay, Mike. Take care.
You too.